Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. To have Matt Randall of Life by Spot coming to us from Austin, Texas. How's it going, Matt?
It's going well.
Are you guys participating in South by Southwest that's going on right now?
I think when you live here after many years, you try to avoid it at all costs. But usually I'm on a vacation this time of year. But we're here with a new company, and we're doing about every other day. We have some type of activation that we're doing in collaboration with another company.
Like what? What kind of things are you guys doing?
We just did a big party the other night with The Hustle. If you know the big email, the big email kind of blog, did a big collaboration party with them, had us out and had myself speaking at that. Maria, my co-founder, was speaking at the South By. And then every year there's a big Austinpreneur party that's put on. And it's kind of the top four or five startups in Austin that put on a big party. So we had that a couple nights ago. So it's always something going on.
You know, I kind of wish we had had this interview a week ago. I just got back from South By 2 days ago, and obviously I missed both those parties. They sound pretty cool. So
I feel like there's always something on every block going on here in South By, but it's a good time. It's a great energy that comes into town. And it's great for employees to get out and kind of see what else is going on in the market.
Yeah, it's a really neat thing. It's I think it's my favorite event of the year. We did, my two Norwegian ladies, Hilda and Helga, there, and we got a 7 foot tall teddy bear and some microphones, and they were walking around interviewing founders doing Teddy Talks. So that's Teddy awesome. Talks. Yeah. And I think they got about 25 of these recorded. So that was kind of our guerrilla strategy. It was fun. Awesome. So what is Life by Spot? What do you guys do?
So Life by Spot, so my co-founder, Maria, we run two very different sides of the company. She was the youngest executive at New York Life and came to me with this idea of, could you do short-term life insurance instead of 10, 20, 30 years? Could you break it down into a day to 30 days and offer it? So that's what we do. We do, imagine Red Bull or GoPro created an insurance company. We are kind of over the top experiential company, and we do accident and injury / life insurance. We cover up to about 20,000 in medical coverage, all the way up to 200,000 in life insurance for around $6 a day. So to us is, no matter if you want to go jump out of a plane, no matter if you want to walk across the street, go mountain biking, snow skiing, anything like that, for about $6-$7 a day, we'll cover all your medical costs if you were to get injured, and life insurance if something tragically were to happen to you.
But is it $6 a day on a annual insurance contract? I mean, I can't go skydiving and pay $6 just for that day, can I?
Through Spot, it's the first time you can. And that's the massive differentiator with us. It's never been done. We're the only company that's ever done it. We're coming to market right now. We're backed by some of the world's largest insurance companies that back us. And that is kind of the uniqueness of Spot, is eventually you'll see us on the bottom of checkout on Vail Ski Resorts and others like travel insurance. Or you can go to lifebyspot.com and buy a policy just for that one day, whatever you're doing. And that's the uniqueness. We don't do 10, 20, 30 year policies. We don't do anything like that. We're creating an entirely new channel, the insurance market, that is short term, fractional ownership insurance. It's never existed before.
Really? So that's very interesting. I guess, you know, you've come from the insurance world, or your partner, your co-founder did. The numbers work out that even if selling a $6 a day policy for one day, it's just a law of large numbers, I guess, right? You have so many people buying these and only a small fraction actually have a claim. Is that how do the numbers work? Because this seems like it doesn't. Well, yeah.
I'll absolutely. It's definitely a volume play. There's no doubt about it. But it's also through the marketing, the ways in which we go about acquiring customers and others. Now, customer acquisition costs for us, as we know, you know, it may cost us $20 to acquire a customer. If we're selling a $6 policy, those numbers don't necessarily net out very well. So our LTV has to be pretty high. Where we look at the ultimate scale for us is in the bottom of checkout of partnerships and other different aspects. Getting on the bottom of checkout, our customer acquisition cost is almost zero. The scalability is very large. So that's the growth. Now the brand comes into play, as we like to call it. Red Bull GoPro creates an insurance company. And that's where the brand really plays into creating a unique dialogue within the market, unlike anything else that's ever done. So we will say now, if we are marketing to people in nursing homes, the numbers would not work out in our favor at all. But we really, within that, when you go through our flow, you can buy policy in, you know, a minute, 2 minutes. It's insanely, insanely fast, fastest in the entire world, actually. So to us was really taking away everything. Insurance companies are traditionally holding on to risk for 10, 20, 30 years when someone buys a policy. For us, they hold on to the risk for 24 hours, 48 hours, 4 days. So we no longer care if you're a smoker, you have, you know, stage 2 cancer, like these different things. Just ultimately to us, we're only looking at the risk across the next few days and the activity and what you're doing. So we're actually changing with the Maria, my co-founder, and the rest of the team has done an unbelievable job, is changing actuarial tables and really looking to redefine what this insurance looks like for this next generation.
It's very fascinating. There's so much I could ask about this, but I guess is it priced differently per activity? In other words, is skydiving priced more than skiing?
So, you know, you would think so, but it's actually not. So we planned on looking at it at the early days, but what was important to us is that we did something that's more or less all cause, something in the sense of we do want to know what you're doing. It allows us to fine tune marketing approaches, partnership integration, and other things. But people perceive risk very differently. One of our advisors is Adrian Ballinger, one of the top mountaineers in the world. He's climbed Everest 8 times, 3 times without oxygen. He's about to climb K2 without oxygen. And so with him, we always say we want consumers to find their Everest. Well, his Everest is Everest. My Everest is Camelback Mountain in Phoenix. And there's a 3-year-old in Crocs passing me, right? But I'm over here scared of heights, grabbing hold of like a rock on the side. So that's my Everest. His Everest is Everest. And so to us, as we encourage people to go out and find that. So pricing shouldn't be much different for my perception of risk compared to your perception of risk. And so that's something that we've said. We don't care if you're walking across the street, if you're driving from LA to San Francisco, or if you want to go jump out of a plane, we look at those risks as the same thing and we price accordingly. Because with the pricing, the insurance company is not holding on to the risk for 20 years. The insurance company is holding on the risk for only a few days, if that. So we can get very aggressive with pricing to where, for the very first time, majority of America can afford this type of insurance to give them that peace of mind when they're going out and living life to the fullest.
Very interesting. I guess, and you've studied the actual injury and death rates of all these different activities. Are there some activities that didn't work out and you don't allow them or ban them?
Yeah, there are. There is, I would say, one particular activity. Well, we don't allow legal activities. So if you want to rob a bank, we don't cover you for that. We'll wish you the best of luck, but we're not going to cover that. We don't cover if you're squirrel suit flying, the proximity flying with the squirrel suits. That is a 60-to-1 death ratio. So that does not work out well. To underwrite that. So every 60 jumps, someone's going down. So for us, there's a few of them that way, but where we really look at it is in life is perception is reality. And so if people perceive risk to be very high, traditionally, their perception far outweighs what the true risk of something is. But in that same moment in time, we want to bring spot to them to give them that kind of peace of mind when they are doing different types of activities. For consumers.
So squirrel suit flying is verboten. What are some of the more common risky activities on the that you're seeing on the platform?
Yeah, so it's been amazing, just the early days. And so partnerships is a gigantic strategy for us. But what we've really seen out of the gate, now we currently have life. We're adding in the injury insurance right now. So we'll cover everything from a sprained ankle all the way up to life for anyone, really. So you could even buy it on your kid whenever they're, you know, going to a trampoline park down the road. You know, and we've seen like these kind of funny things come out. But, you know, major things like road cycling is a huge thing that we're seeing. I'm actually in the midst of training for an Ironman, which is a terrible decision that I've made. And so the in things like snow skiing, road cycling, motorcycle riding, a number of others, like it continues to blow our mind when people say like, oh, I would love it for X. And we just don't think about it. There's a lot of shiny objects around this company, and it's really about the company, you know, focusing on saying, this is who we're going to be, this is how we're coming to market, and then we'll ultimately scale over time. But we see all sorts of, you know, kind of hilarious things. We joke around on there that we cover bachelor and bachelorette parties, which we do. We cover pretty much anything and everything. And we cover lawnmower racing. I think is hilarious. I don't even know really what it is, but I look forward to doing it. And so we encourage our employees, we encourage the team at all times to get out and live life, do the activities that we market. We cover thousands of activities, anything you could think of, but we only market select few. And so get out there and try those at any given moment in time. And so to us is eventually we'll all go lawnmower racing, which I think you have to do in the backwoods of Texas or Louisiana someplace.
That all sounds fun. I don't know what that is either, but it sounds great. Yeah, I was just in, 2 weeks ago, I was in Maui, and I rented a dirt bike, like an off-road motorcycle, and kind of took it off on the road to Hana and went through Hana, and that's just getting dumped on by rain the whole time, then found a few little goat trails and then rode it all the way around the island. But I thought about like my life insurance and, you know, I didn't actually check on whether it was up to date, but I've got kids and stuff. So the thought crossed my mind. Anyway.
Phone in about a minute and a half had a little extra coverage for yourself.
Yeah. Well, especially even for small injuries, right? Because like you're going 20 miles an hour, the catastrophic injury is kind of low, but like a wipeout rolling down the hill or something is probably kind of medium high.
Me, actually, I was back home from skiing a couple of weeks ago with some buddies at a Crested Butte, and I ended up cracking a rib, like myself with my pole. But it was this idea of like, I know they can't really do anything for a broken rib, so I ended up just hanging out with my buddies and drinking tequila. But I could have, if we would have had the injury at that moment in time, which will happen in about a month, if I would have had that, I would have gone straight and gotten an x-ray to see how bad it was. And so we do want to offer that to people at those times to say, you know, for an extra couple bucks a day, it's an absolute no-brainer to get coverage just to make sure, you know, I'm not stuck with a $6,000 bill because my deductible is $7,000.
Isn't there something of an adverse selection problem though? Like, aren't you going to be getting some of the more risky people who are constantly jumping off cliffs and doing crazy stuff? I mean, you're probably making money on the sort of casual skier who goes up twice a year and just wants a little insurance. But like, is there a problem that you might be attracting the really risky folks that's going to cost you a lot?
So, you know, I think this is a hypothesis, and ultimately time will tell where we ultimately net out. But like, you know, we have insurance companies that we're working with. We can actually cover U.S. military on deployments, right, and all these others. But what we find is like we wouldn't market to that individual because that individual that is doing high risk activities, you know, and they actually think they're invincible.
Yeah.
Right. So to us is it's actually to people like myself, instead of Adrian climbing Everest thinking he's going to be totally fine all the time, it's me climbing Camelback and I'm like, oh my God, or me going backcountry skiing for the first time and thinking, oh my God, this thing is really, really steep, right? And so we actually, what we found, we did about 3 to 4 months, and we continue to do it on a biweekly basis, qual and quant studies at all times, better understanding and refining down who our target market is. Because, and what we continue to see is, it's not the person that is doing the most extreme things actually believes they're invincible. It's actually the people right behind them that are doing it every so often that actually know the risk in which they're kind of stepping into. It's also very fascinating that it's not necessarily the person doing the activity we'll be marketing to, it's actually the spouse of that individual because they think of risk differently.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, one or two more questions and I want to talk about fundraising, but how does it work on the back end? So are you bundling all these micro policies together and then selling them off to larger insurers or reinsurers? I don't know how this industry works.
Yeah, you know, I would say a year and a half ago, I didn't have any idea either. It was kind of drinking from a fire hose, learning how this whole industry does operate. And it's actually pretty incredible. The team has done a phenomenal job. We're the only company in the world doing this type of coverage. And we know there's going to be multiple companies coming out in time. But from our component, what happens is, so Hannover Re, the third largest reinsurance company in the world, is backing and takes on the risk behind the company payouts and claims and other things. Fidelity Life Association is our carrier partner that sits between. So there's us on the front. We take on all the customer acquisition side of the business, but in the distribution, but we don't take on any claim payout or, you know, those different angles. And then there's a Hanover, and then there's the carrier partner, which is Fidelity Life, that sits in the middle, and we utilize their paper. So the policy you get is actually a Fidelity Life policy. And then that is underwritten totally from Hanover Re, which is our main reinsurance partner. So they split the risk on the company, and then we're the acquisition channel.
Very interesting. Yeah.
We'll always look to work with Hanover on a reinsurance, but we'll work with multiple different types of carrier partners to take on different risks behind the company. But the consumer will only know spot and only know the pricing on the front end, incredibly simple process. And so we're not an aggregator. They'll never see like 5 prices from different companies and stuff like that. That's not who we are. They'll just be 1, 2, 3 good, better, best pricing. And then we'll manage that risk on the backside with the insurance companies.
Interesting. You're probably too young to remember there, but I remember as a kid, there at the airport, there would be these kiosks where you could buy insurance for a flight, like just that flight. And it's just like, and you know, it was kind of an interesting concept, right?
Wildly successful. The reason it failed is there's a lot of fraud behind it. But yeah, that was, we always joked about when we launched the company, we were going to bring those kiosks back to the airports for fun. But I don't think we're doing that route because about a 5-minute quant study will teach you no one's scared of flying anymore. Unless it's on, you know, one of the planes that's a discussion right now.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe that's changing though, like yeah. Given what's going on with the 737 MAX, right?
Yeah. So, you know, from our side of the business, we're definitely, you know, we look at fun and unique ways to tell the brand story and kind of get that out there. But we also are highly focused on the types of markets in which we're marketing into.
Yeah. Very cool. Okay. You know, last comment. It's funny, flying back from Austin 2 days ago, I actually did, first time in 1,000 flights that I actually like thought about it and checked what plane I was going to be on and like, you know, did a little research. It was actually in the back of my head, like first time forever. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I fly a lot as well. And it's, you know, in today's news cycles, it is, you know, it's definitely relevant. Probably a week you won't ever think about it again.
Yeah. Okay. How much you guys raised over how many rounds?
To date, we've raised $6 million on the company. We've yet to launch, really, well, we've launched a company, but we haven't started marketing the company at all. We're really just learning a couple different things. And we're in the midst of raising another 4 on the company right now, strategic money from insurance companies. And that should close in the next couple weeks.
Great. So this was the first round was a Series A or a seed, or what were you calling it?
You know, it's always funny. My last company, company called Twyla, I've raised right at $20 million from that company. And so whenever I went to go raise money from this company, what was used to be a Series A is now a seed, I guess. And so it was kind of the different terminology. So we've done an angel round early days. We did a $2 million round from angels. There was a specific reason why we did angels early on and did not allow venture into that round, which I can get into if you would like. And then we raised a $4 million seed round, which we were very fortunate and very lucky. We were oversubscribed and by 4x within 2 weeks on the company. And then we raised that end of last year. And then we weren't planning on raising another round, but there's been a lot of interest from insurance companies, venture teams to invest in the company. And so we're currently, which is very unique, structuring a convertible note at the current moment to convert in at the Series A, which will probably go raise and then our next round once we hit certain metrics in beginning Q1, Q2 of 2020.
Let's pick these apart because I think this is an interesting strategy. An angel round and then a seed round and now kind of a strategic round with convertible note. Let's go to angel round. Why did you, as you mentioned, put together only an angel round, no VCs in there? What was the thought process? Yeah,
I think a lot of young entrepreneurs have this glorified idea of wanting their idea being validated by a venture capitalist and say they raise money from a VC. Which, you know, I get that. I think I was there at a point in time as well. And what happens when you raise from a VC is they have they have their LPs behind the company. They are investors within their funds, and within their fund, they have to have, you know, in every deal, let's call it 15% on the cap table. But when you allow them in super early venture onto your cap table, now you've just created what I call another co-founder on the company super early on. So while you're still understanding the business, while you're still building, while you're still doing these things, you just put a gigantic whale on your cap table that now has a big say in your business. So what we decided to do was structure a convertible security at that time, SAFE, and raise angel money, knowing that we were going to give away about the same amount of equity, but it was going to be in tiny little slivers to multiple different people that were going to accumulate to the same amount of equity. But Maria and myself would still maintain major, major control over the whole entire thing. And we could kind of select the type of investors we wanted to go after that would help us scale the company. So that was our strategy and why we didn't allow venture into the early days of the company.
Yeah, it makes sense. What was your strategy for putting together this set of angels? Were these folks you knew? What was your previous company you mentioned?
Called Twyla. It was backed by Google Ventures, Redpoint, IVP.
Cool. Okay. So you had a track record. So maybe talk about putting together the angel round. Did you just tap your own network? Did you reach out to people, angels from the insurance world? What was the strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone now, I think having a previous company, now it was not the success we had hoped it to be. We had raised a lot of money and we, you know, ultimately never truly found the product market fit that we needed to. So I'd say I've raised 20 million, I've spent 20 million. So within that is, I think this idea of this glorification of, yes, we've raised money behind this company, but, you know, I would say, you know, in raising money behind Spot, we were told nine out of 10 times, you know, probably 49 out of 50 times, no behind Spot in every single pitch because it was too big of an idea. No one thought anyone would underwrite this. No one thought we could change insurance, et cetera. And we just continued to stay on that focus. And so what I always do is I find, call it a higher net worth type individual. And then if I pitch them and they say no or yes, don't really care. I just continue to pound on them, trying for other introductions. I also, you know, in years past when I was younger, I would network like hell. and just try to go to every single thing I could, make myself, you know, go in there, introduce myself. What's the worst thing anyone could tell me? Was no. My background is very different. Maria and I were both raised by special forces. My dad was a Navy SEAL. Her dad was a Green Beret. And so we've also, I'm highly dyslexic. I was deaf till the age of four. I learned to fully speak when I was 14 and all these things. So like, to me, it's like, what's the worst someone can tell me is no, like rock on. I'm going to go find a yes someplace. So to me was, I think everyone wants it to be very easy and they wanted to say like, here's a website you can go to and here's a list of all angel investors and you can send a pitch out and someone's going to say yes, right? But I think the best way for me was, I mean, this company, we raised $100,000 early on from a guy randomly at a restaurant that was sitting next to me that I just started talking to and told about Spot. A check like a week later. So to me, it's always about like opportunities always right next to you. It's always about like, you know, going after it and not being afraid to be told no. So that's what kind of the approach we took at the beginning of this company. Now, ultimately, and I'm taking that with other companies, ultimately with Spot, we have an incredible angel network behind this company. And so there is even, I'll say this, you know, in all transparency, the very first investor into Spot it was a family member of mine. And I had never raised family money before and never allowed it into the company. And that was a big deal. So we have everyone from that all the way up to like prolific angels to CEOs of companies to insurance execs and other things. So to me, it's like, I never leave a stone unturned. And as Maria likes to say, you know, I will pretty much fight for, because at the end of the day, early days, the money you raise is the money you pay yourself with and your employees.
What did you, just a little bit more on the angel round, we'll move on. What, you mentioned high net worth folks, you're hustling people at restaurants and probably tapping your network and kind of leaving no stone unturned, but were you tapping like the Austin Angel scene? Were you purely just working through connections? Like, this is a question a lot of founders have. Like, this all sounds good in theory, but how do you actually identify high net worth folks to pitch, right? I'm not afraid of hearing no, but I'm having trouble getting in front of or identifying the high net worth folks to begin with. Any tips or thoughts there?
It is such a great question. I think I've had the privilege over the 8 years that I've lived in Austin to have networked myself through those 8 years into a network of, I know those types of investors. Now, what I don't think, and one of our employees on the company, actually amazing employee on the company, he actually used to be a coffee barista at a coffee shop in town. It used to serve me coffee all the time, would just pound on me all the time about getting a meeting and all these different things. And now he works for us and runs the experiential arm of the company. What I don't think young entrepreneurs do enough, and I do this still to this day, is if I really want a meeting with someone, there are multiple different ways to get a hold of that person. One person I'm trying to get a hold of right now is Nick Woodman, the CEO of GoPro and the founder. I can't figure out a way into him. I've been spending about a year trying to figure out a way into this guy. Uh-huh. We'll find a way to get his attention over the next year to 2 years. That I can guarantee. And so to me, it's the reaching out, finding people with good networks, you know, and trying to find a way into, and just, you know, if someone emailed me and said, hey, I'd love to go grab coffee and learn more about certain type of company and any angels you may have, you know, and get your thoughts. I think a lot of entrepreneurs know what it feels like to be in that world, in that role, and would take people up on those meetings all the time. And I've had a lot of success doing that in the past and building my network that way.
Very good. Okay, let's go forward to the seed round, the 4 million oversubscribed seed round. Let's talk about how you put that together and how did it become oversubscribed, the most beautiful word in fundraising?
Yeah. No doubt on it. Again, everything I'm saying, I can only speak from my own experience. People have so many different experiences that work for them that didn't work for me, or things that work for me that didn't work for them. them. You know, how we started that, so we didn't have to raise money, which is always a great thing. I think anytime a founder, no matter your idea or what it is, you sound desperate, no one wants to give you money. Best advice I was ever given was ask for advice, get funding, ask for funding, get advice. So for me was when, so I went out to LA, I took my mom actually for her birthday to the Ellen show. And so we were out there and I kicked around. I told Maria, maybe we'll look to raise some funding in the year. Let's just see kind of what the interest is. And so I went out to LA, I kicked the tires with a couple of VCs. Again, I didn't know them. I asked someone that knew VCs out in LA on the company. I gave him some advisor shares on the company. He introduced me to 30 VCs around the country that I didn't know. And it was 100% worth the advisory shares for introductions all over the country. And that's something I think a lot of founders are very greedy with their equity. I would much rather own 0.01% of Google than 95% of another company. So to me was... he made a lot of introductions. I went out there, I kicked the tires. There was a ton of interest. I told everyone I wasn't raising, but I just wanted to see kind of what the interest was out there. I went out to New York a couple weeks later, talked about raising. There was a ton of interest. And then I said, okay, maybe I'll raise 3 million, maybe 4. We had a couple term sheets come across right at that time when we kind of announced the funding. I went through kind of one thing I think done well in the past is build decks. I'm highly visual, so stories mean a lot to me. And a deck should be a story, painting a very large vision behind the company, not doing 5,000, you know what I mean, you know, annual or monthly or anything like that, MRR or anything like that. Like, that just doesn't paint a giant picture. To me, it's like I take revenue out of it. This is what we're building in the early days. You can fund it or not. And so did that. We ended up going with Silverton in Austin. We had a previous relationship. I've known them. Why we went with them also, they weren't the best of terms to go with, but I think a lot of us look at it and we say, you know, we have multiple different funding opportunities and we say, we want this one because, you know, it's the best terms for us founders. But what we don't look at is there are a couple of very large Bay Area funds that had put their name into the bucket for that funding. What we found was these funds traditionally write $10 to $30 million checks. I was only raising $4 million, which I was not going to allow them to take the whole round. I wanted my early investors to re-up as well to be able to give them that opportunity. Yeah. So we raised $2.5 to $3 million from this venture. Well, I would much rather a smaller fund, a $100, $200 million fund, to write that, get their 12, 15% on the cap table, a smaller fund than someone that can write a $10, $30 million check to get their 15% for only $3 million, right? So I would rather go to them later on for a much larger check because like Silverton couldn't play at a later date in the company. So we went with them and there's a funny story around that. I was at F1 and they said, we do not want you in market on Monday. It was Sunday. We want it closed. We want it done. We do not want you negotiating against us. What will it take to make this work? And I texted him back, which I'll always keep these text messages. And I texted him back and said, this is the term. I talked to Maria and our general counsel, said, what would it be? And we agreed on it. I texted him what the terms would be. We'll sign that day. They have to do it. And they texted me back 30 minutes later and said, done. Paperwork's in your in your email, which I was blown away, they agreed to it. And they said, we need a signature in the next couple of hours. I was at F1. My wife was like, get off the phone, going to race. And I said, no, this is one of the times I have to do this. And she was like, get off the phone. And so lo and behold, we signed the documents and we were very happy to close a deal with Silverton.
I love that story. That's a great story. You're at the race and, you know, negotiating by text. Was there any particular term? You don't have to give the details of what but anything you were really focused on in that text exchange? Like, yeah.
Yeah. I think that a big for us is, when you're raising money, you're giving part of your baby away, right? No matter what, But and once you raise it and once you sign that, like, you can't ever really get it back. Like, that's gone, right? And so it's just about maintaining control of the company. And I think it's the small ways. I've seen a couple of young companies do this, is they get so enamored with the VCs that they're like, yes, I'll sign. You guys are going to invest in us. I'll sign. The thing is like, you know, venture capitalists, they're looking out for themselves. Yes, they want you to be motivated and work and stuff like that. But like, ultimately, they have investors they're signing on to, right? Like, I always joke, like, VCs are great, but they're investing someone else's money. Angels are amazing because they're investing their own. So that, to me, that's always kind of the push and pull, is just maintaining the control in the early days. And I'm talking about voting rights. I'm talking about board seats. I'm talking about things like that, not necessarily valuation.
Yeah, very good. Very good. I think that's important, and it's probably not talked about enough in these type of podcasts, which I should probably drill into this stuff more often. I want to kind of jump around just a tiny bit, but in your strategy of kind of asking for advice, you know, get funding, right, and vice versa, what was your actual, and you're going out to LA and then New York, were you actually, you know, getting introduced and saying, hey, we're not raising money, I'd just like to run this idea? I guess, how do you flip it from I'm asking you for advice to actually making it a pitch for money? Do you just say, I'm not raising money, I just want to get your feedback, and then see if they kind of pursue you? How did the flip go?
So I think one thing that's happened with me, just I think by being deaf at an early age, I catch up on visual cues very quickly. And so I definitely watch a lot. Now, I think at all times it's very powerful when you don't have to have the money, right? I think so much of us also, like, I am most enamored, and I have so much respect for people that build companies without raising capital. If I could build a company without raising capital, oh my God, that would be incredible to go do it. And so, but in raising that capital, I think whenever I'm sitting down with an angel or a venture, it's very different. When you're sitting down with a VC, they know you're raising capital most of the time. They're usually not going to take that meeting if they're not to kind of waste their time on it, unless they're really interested in the space. But I also would be very, you know, very careful meeting with the VC if you're not necessarily raising money, because they will not sign NDAs at all. So they do. So for me, anytime I sit down, you know, a lot of it is, you know, it's this chess game that I play, and, you know, wanting people's advice and like saying to you, like, about, like, if I was pitching you over this podcast and we were sitting here, you know, my whole thing for you would be like, hey, I'm starting up this insurance company and we're kind of creating this new channel in the market. But what I would love to learn from you from the pitching side, you hear this from so many different founders, I would love to know, how would you pitch this idea for Spot? You know what I mean? So I would walk you through what it is and want you to give me the idea, because now you're about to convince me why I need to raise money on Spot. And so now, hopefully in that time, you're going to convince yourself. And so I do that with a lot of people. I think with, I will say one person, let me think of one person, for instance. One of the main guys behind Austin Ventures back in the day is a big investor in us. You know, and going in to pitch him, the whole idea was, I researched him. I knew he loved big ideas, gigantic ideas. They kind of binary decision. It's either going to go to a billion or it's going to go to zero, something, nothing in between. And so I knew he loved that, right? So I was going to frame something that way. And so in talking with him, I just said at the very beginning, you know, let's go have coffee. I finally got that nailed down. And then we sat down and I said, hey, you know, you have done an incredible job, you know, with Austin Ventures. You've built some unbelievably world-renowned companies that have sold multiple companies for over $1 billion. I would love to understand, if you can walk me through, this is what I'm thinking for the company. I would love to get your feedback on, like, if we're going to scale this from customer acquisition costs for all these different things, what your thoughts would be. But once I framed it to him that way, he started looking at it from an operations type role and looking into it and be like, oh my God, like, you could literally scale this with almost zero customer acquisition costs, and it's insurance, which is actually the highest customer acquisition cost. Oh my God, this channel is gigantic. Within 15, 20 minutes, he was asking me what's the biggest check he could write into the company. And so for me, it was all, instead of coming to him saying, we're the best team in the world. We're incredible. You have to put money into us. We're going to be a $1 billion company. Now he's looking at every way to prove me wrong and to tell me I'm not going to do that. Instead of me flipping around and saying, like, with your past experience, can you help me validate like what I'm thinking and how you would look at it in kind of a CEO role? So I do that a lot, not only from, you know, raising money side of it, but I also do it from employees, you know, like recruiting employees and a number of other things, because I want them to feel like they're in the power, and it's not, you know, I would say, myself, there's not a dictatorship over here.
Those are super good. I think that's a really hard, you know, black belt level thing to do, to kind of do that, that flip versus I'm just pitching you, to kind of, you know, get your thoughts on how you would pitch this and can you help validate what I'm thinking. I think those are really good judo moves.
Funny thing that, you know, I was taught this by my previous mentor, previous partner of mine, is a guy named Brian Sharples, founder and CEO of HomeAway and VRBO. And so he taught me a lot in watching these different things. And I think what people are so fearful of is that in the early days of pitching, you're pitching a vision. You're not pitching the numbers that you currently have, anything like that. You're pitching a vision that you are going to go succeed, and this is a gigantic opportunity in the market. And within that is, we kind of, it's a laughing thing that we use in marketing and all that. It's like, you've got to use a little Barnum and Bailey and a little smoke behind the mirrors, and that idea of, like, we always call it, you know what I mean, where's the Barnum and Bailey? And that is I can tell you, John Foley, the founder of Peloton, I've gotten to know, and every single one of his pitches in the early days, he would tell everyone he's selling the company for over $1 billion. Every single one. And everyone would look at him like he's nuts. But the thing is he believed it. He truly did believe that. And I think that's also something that's not pushed out there so much, is that it's not being naive, but it's also about believing in your vision and knowing that you can kind of execute across it.
Very good. All right. This was great stuff. So now you're looking towards a strategic round. Any thoughts on that, or how you're, I guess the thought is just to have these big, deep vested parties from the insurance world putting in money. What are you thinking? Yeah,
so we weren't planning on this round. This is really unique. I've never done this before at this stage of the company. And so we have had a lot of interest from insurance companies, their venture arms. You know, insurance companies, these companies have more money than we could ever fathom. So they have venture arms investing in kind of new technology that's coming out into the market. And so there is one company in particular that has shown great interest that would be a great aligned partner for us. And we couldn't raise another round right now off valuation and all these things. We just raised another one, and we just raised our last round in November. And so it just wouldn't make sense for the company from a dilution, from all these different angles. So we decided we would structure a convertible security as of right now. And so onto the company at a cap, a very high cap on the company, with a discount in case we raised at a lower round, that they would get preferential terms no matter what. So we're working through that with them at the current moment and what that looks like. We should have that across the line here very shortly, but that's really unique. It allows us not only new opportunities for distribution and a number of other things, but it also allows us more funding to where we didn't think we were going to raise this funding. So it's just kind of gravy. But within that is what it allows us to do is capture market share. It allows us to find something that's working really well, double down on it, knowing that it's continuing to extend our burnout because we have specific metrics we need to go hit within the next, I would say, 12 to 18 months. When we hit those metrics, we could hit them in 6 months. When we hit those metrics behind the company, we will then go look to raise the next round at a much higher valuation. But one thing why I think an insurance company is interested in us right now is I don't think enough founders look at the feasibility to get to profitability within their business model at a particular time. I still think I continue to hear all the time user growth and all these different things around continual to hear this idea of like, we just need users, to where I think for us was from day one, it was about building a profitable company that can really get to sustainability quickly and not have to continue to raise money.
Yeah, smart. Could you use this strategic round to get, you know, the top insurance companies to invest in you as a way of preventing them from funding a competitor or a future competitor? You know what I mean? Kind of lock them in to take that option off the market for competitor.
You mean the Uber model? You mean Uber?
Kind of, yeah. Right.
Fun lift. You know, it's not our number one reason for doing it. But it's not our number 10th reason for doing it. So there is definitely that idea. The company we're raising from is one of the largest insurance companies in the world. I would raise a dollar from them just to have them as a partner on the company. And that's where I look at from a strategic side. That's the reason we're raising money from them. It's not because we need money necessarily from them. It's more on the strategic side of the playbook for the company.
All right, we're almost done. I know this is a long one. Maybe you don't want to answer this because you don't want more people moving to Austin, but any tips for this new crop of entrepreneurs in Austin, things they should check out, resources, networks, other things for like the Austin scene?
You know, it's a great question. You know, I am not as integrated into the Austin startup scene as I probably should be. And I know there's things out there that people really love, and it's Capital Factory and a number of other things that are kind of out there, and what Josh Baer and some others have done is great for the Austin startup scene. I do things, I think, a little bit differently. I don't like being in incubators. I don't like being in WeWork. I like to have the company really tight-knit in its own space, really building the company in as little distractions as possible. You know, from my side is there's an incredible scene here in Austin and more capital moving to town. I think, you know, more than anything, I always welcome, you know, people reaching out, you know, helping people raise money, helping like walking people through that. I've even sent, you know, previous decks that I've raised off to people before so they can kind of, you know, structure things off of that. And so to me, like, that's more of a personal thing. I think in Austin, there's so many meetups and groups and things like that. I would just be very cognizant of the people that are talking. Have they done it before? Have they done it multiple times? Or have they only done it once and gotten lucky? And so that's my thing. A lot of people love to give advice, but to me, advice is like assholes. Everyone has one. And so to me, that's the, you know, just get it from someone that has done it multiple times over and has shown success. But again, I would say I've done it multiple times, but more than anything, I think what people don't talk about enough is I get told no way more than I ever get told yes.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I think that's a good common trait of entrepreneurs. They just don't hear the no or keep moving forward anyway, right? Matt, this is great. Awesome. Any last thoughts? Or I guess if people want to learn more, it's lifebyspot.com. Can I buy a policy today if I want to go do some crazy activity this afternoon?
Yeah, you can buy a life insurance policy today for 1 day to 30 days. You just go on there. It takes about a minute, 2 minutes to get through the process super fast. You can check us out at lifebyspot.com. In the next month or so, you'll see press and everything coming out. We'll be announcing the accident. So we'll be covering everything from a sprained ankle, broken arm, all the way up to life, medical bills and everything. So look for Spot. Like I said, it's Red Bull GoPro creates an insurance company at this moment in time. And if anyone ever even wants to reach out to me personally for any advice or anything, more than happy. And that's just Matt at lifebyspot.com.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for your time here. And this is cool. Do you cover sailing, like solo sailing?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's my other risky habit that I am involved in. So I'll have to take up on that. Very cool. I will definitely be a customer at some point. I love it. Thank you so much for your time. Good luck, and we'll catch you after your next raise. Perhaps we'll talk about strategic investing some more.
All right, perfect. Thank you guys so much for the time.
Bye. Thank you.